Oh my goodness, everyone became quiet as I came up here. Can you all hear me in back? All right. Good afternoon. My name is Russ Fetterman, and I'm Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at the Department of Student Health here at University of Virginia, and I would like to welcome you all to this afternoon's presentation. Today, we have a giant with us, although she's really not that big. By my account, maybe she's 5'7" or so. But Dr. K. Redfield Jameson has singularly been responsible for bringing bipolar disorder out of psychiatric units and psychiatric consultation services and into the public awareness. She's translated this complex and often puzzling disorder into very human language, initially through the lens of her 1995 memoir, An Unquiet Mind, and subsequently through multiple books, articles, and medical texts. Her body of work has positioned her as one of the nation's preeminent authorities on bipolar illness and affective illnesses. Dr. Jameson, on behalf of UVA Counseling and Psychological Services, as well as the Department of Psychiatry and Neurobiological Services, let me say it is truly an honor to have you here with us today. The remainder of this introduction, however, is not about Dr. Jameson. It's about a former patient named Chadrick Lane. And you're probably wondering, where in the world is he going with this? Well, Chad Lane was a student who graduated from UVA a year and a half ago. And during his last couple of years at UVA, he was seen at Counseling and Psychological Services for treatment of bipolar disorder. Even at that time, Chad was clear that he aspired to become a psychiatrist. I believe he wanted to truly make a difference in others' lives. He wanted to effectively help people to navigate some of the complex life challenges that he's already faced. Chad is a successful kind of guy, like many UVA graduates are. He was accepted into a post-baccalaureate fellowship, research fellowship at NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health. And while there, he applied to and was accepted to medical school at the University of Virginia, and I'm pleased to say that we'll have Chad back here this coming fall. Now, an example of Chad's initiative is that he independently reached out to Dr. Jameson and invited her correspondence with him. And I suspect Dr. Jameson probably recognized a kindred spirit whose path was perhaps not all that different than hers. So Chad and Dr. Jameson began some correspondence, and the next thing I knew, Chad had contacted me wanting to know if UVA would be receptive to a visit from Dr. Jameson. Well, Chad, the answer is a resounding yes. And now that you're both here together, perhaps you can pick up this narrative and provide your own personal introduction of Dr. Jameson. So I would now like to introduce you to Mr. Chadrick Lane.
Thank you for the very kind introduction, Dr. Fetterman. Dr. Fetterman, Russ, without you, this talk could have not happened. You have been an extraordinarily helpful person in organizing today, and I thank you a million times over. Our community here at the University of Virginia is better off knowing you're a part of it. I would also like to thank the University of Virginia Bookstore, Counseling and Psychological Services, the Department of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences, Terry Johnson for securing our venue today, and Virginia Carter, Director of External Relations for Student Affairs, in her efforts for publicizing this event. Not long ago, I, like many others in this audience, experienced a tragic loss in my life. It was then that my father, only 47, lost a long battle. He took his life by gunshot less than 1 year following a very difficult and debilitating stroke. After that day, I would never see my father again. I would never see my friend. The pain was so agonizing that no amount of words today can fully describe it. I eventually entered a dark place following his death, a place where my days seemed to be void of all I once cherished. These valleys would grow into flights of uncontrollable anxiety, irritability, and impulsivity. I felt as if I no longer held the reins to my own mind. This pattern led to my losing the will to live. Like my father, I attempted to end my life. Unlike my father, I did not succeed. How thankful I am for that. How lucky I am. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder type 2 and was one of the fortunate patients to begin a treatment plan. It was during my stay at the hospital that a psychiatrist asked me if I had read An Unquiet Mind. I said no, I hadn't, but I'll check it out. It was then that I discovered the story with which I would again find hope. It was then that I found Kay Jamison. Dr. Jamison is a world-renowned expert on bipolar disorder, co-authoring Manic Depressive Illness, Bipolar Disorders, and Recurrent Depression, which has become a leading text on the subject. She is the author of An Unquiet Mind, a memoir detailing her experiences with bipolar disorder. Writing this was a brave step for Dr. Jamison, and as an advocate for eliminating the stigma of mental illness, I am deeply grateful for her work. Dr. Jamison has also authored the esteemed works Touched with Fire, Exuberance, and Night Falls Fast. She delivers such profound, moving lessons in the most eloquent of prose, which has earned her the respect and admiration of readers across the globe. Receiving her PhD at the University of California, Los Angeles, Dr. Jamison would later join the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University, where she is now a full professor and co-director of the Mood Disorders Clinic. Her most recent memoir, Nothing Was the Same, is an emotional recount of the grief she faced during and following her late husband's illness. Ladies and gentlemen, I have never read a work that taps into the human heart as much as this, and I highly encourage you to grab a copy following this talk. So, without further delay, it is my honor to present a person of so much achievement in light of so many challenges. I hope you are all as inspired by her life as much as I have been. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Kay Jamison.
Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's quite wonderful to feel that one might have had an effect on such an incredibly nice person as well as such an extraordinarily talented one. So thank you. And thanks to the University of Virginia for inviting me back. I'm always sort of amazed that they did invite me back, having been here before. But thank you. I appreciate it. I am talking today about grief and depression. I'm just fresh off a kind of a book tour from hell, about 30 days, 20 cities in 30 days or something, and for a book I just recently published called Nothing Was the Same, which is a follow-up memoir to An Unquiet Mind. What I thought I would do is do a little bit of the reading that I would do on in bookstores and so forth on a book tour, but then I really wanted to focus on something that I think is particularly important in anyone who lives, which is namely, how do you tell the difference between grief and depression, particularly if you have a propensity toward depression yourself? This is a book that I wrote after my husband's death, my late husband's death. And so I want to start off by reading a bit from the book about my husband, about my relationship with my husband, because grief always is in the context of the loss of an individual life. and then talk briefly about some of the similarities and just differences between grief and depression. The book that I wrote, Nothing Was the Same, is really an elegy. It's a love story, but woven into it is the nature of grief, why it exists, and how one imagines one's way out of it, because ultimately it is grief's great task to force one into coming to a new kind of relationship with the dead. One of the things that I was particularly interested in, as someone who has severe bipolar illness myself and who just barely survived a nearly lethal suicide attempt, is the distinction between grief and depression, because everyone in this room will grieve, and a large percentage of you will have depression. And the question is, how do you make the distinctions, and does it matter? And the fact is, it matters a very great deal to make that distinction. So I'd like to start with just reading the prologue from my new book, and then talk a little bit about my husband and our relationship, and then talk about grief and depression. This podium is really foreboding. Does this seem foreboding to you? It is tall. It's just like a feel. It's like a barrier. When I was young, I thought that fearlessness and an easy way with love would see me to the other side of anything. Madness taught me otherwise. In the wake of my first insanity, I assumed less and dreaded more. My mind was suspect. There was no arguing with the new reality. I had to learn to live with a brain that demanded more coddling than I would have liked, and because of this, I avoided perturbance as best I could. Need-wise, I avoided love. I kept my mind on a short lead and my heart yet closer in. Had I cared enough to look, I would have scarcely recognized either of them. Before mania whipped through my brain, I had been curious always to go to the far field, to what lay beyond. After, I drew back from life and watered down my dreams. I retaught myself to think and to negotiate the world, and as the world measures things, I did well enough. I was content in my life and found purpose in academic and clinical work. I wrote and taught, saw patients, and kept my struggles with manic depressive illness to myself. I worked hard, driven to understand the illness from which I suffered. I settled in, I settled down, I settled. In a slow and fitful way, predictability insinuated itself into my life, and with it came a certain peace I was not aware had been missing. Grateful for this, and because I had no reason to know otherwise, I assumed that peace was provisional upon an absence of passion or anything that could forcibly disturb my senses. I avoided love. This lasted for a while, although not perhaps as long as it seemed. Then I met a man who upended my cautious stance toward life. He did not believe, as I had for so long, that to control my mind, I must first control my heart. He loved the woman he imagined I must have been before bowing to fear. He prodded my resistance with grace and undermined my wariness with laughter. He could say the unthinkable because he instinctively knew that his dry wit and gentle ways would win me over. They did. He was deft with my shifting moods. He liked my fearlessness, and he brought it back as a gift to me. Far from finding the intensity of my nature disturbing, he gravitated toward it. He induced me to risk much by assuming a portion of the risk himself, and he persuaded me to write from my heart. He loved in me what I had forgotten was there. We had nearly 20 years together. He was my husband, colleague, and friend. When he became ill and we knew he would die, he became my mentor in how to die with the grace by which he lived. What he could not teach me, no one could, was how to contend with the grief of losing him. It has been said that grief is a kind of madness. I disagree. There is a sanity to grief in its just proportion of emotion to cause that madness does not have. Grief, given to all, is a generative and a human thing. It provides a path, albeit a broken one. by which those who grieve can find their way. Still, it is grief's fugitive nature that one does not know at the start that such a path exists. I knew madness well, but I understood little of grief, and I was not always certain which was grief and which was madness. Grief, as it transpires, has its own territory. My husband, Richard Wyatt, was a physician and a scientist, and being a doctor and a scientist were the essence of his life, the most important things by far. He published 800 papers, mostly on schizophrenia, and he was director of the neuropsychiatry branch at the National Institute of Mental Health. He wrote 6 books and was enormously dyslexic. He was also easy on the eyes, very easy on the eyes, and he was catnip to women, including this one. His dyslexia was an important part of who he was, not only because he required enormous amount of hard work to write almost every sentence that he ever wrote, and had to have his patients read back to him every prescription that he wrote. But he also was very fortunate, and she's here today, Yolene Henter, to have a superb medical editor. And then I did some editing for him as well. But he still, it was an act of character from the time he was a very young child to have to figure out how to string words together and string letters together, not just words. We were as different as two people imaginable. He used to love to tell anyone who would listen about our first Christmas together in Georgetown, where we got a small tree, Christmas tree, about yay big, and I went to the drugstore and got 12 strands of lights, Christmas tree lights. He was outraged, really genuinely annoyed, thinking I was extravagant, and insisted that I take them back to the drugstore, which I refused to do. And I tried to convince him that there was no such thing as too many Christmas tree lights. There was no such thing as too much joy in the world. We were very different temperamentally, but we had interests very much in common, and we were crazy about each other. He was particularly supportive of my work, my writing of An Unquiet Mind. He was the person who advocated for it, who said, no matter what happens, I will back you up, and there were a lot of things that did happen. But he was a great believer that one of the problems in our lives of dealing with mental illness with everyone that we knew and treated and whatever was that people who were professionals who had mental illness kept quiet. And all the people, the hundreds of thousands of people who got good medical care and responded very well to it, because they kept quiet, the public had a very skewed notion of what mental illness was all about and how treatable it was. And he said time and time again, people with mental illness need every voice that they can get. He not only said he would support me, he did support me. I can't imagine if I'd tried to put somebody together and designed a person to be more supportive of my illness, I could not have imagined it. And actually, one of the reasons I wrote my book was because I'm not only someone who has this illness and studies it, but I'm also a family member. I have a lot of this illness in my family. And I think that family members don't get enough credit for how difficult it is to deal with bipolar illness. And that's just true. You know, I mean, everybody gets illnesses, and they're all difficult. But it is difficult. And he did, I think, a quite admirable job. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't very hard for him at times and hard for the two of us. So I just want to read you a brief description of an evening that we had. It was sort of a turning point in our relationship to my illness. We were working at home. Glancing around his study, I saw his black doctor's bag in the corner of the room, sitting on top of a file cabinet. It seemed odd, although I'd never thought about it before. Why did he have his doctor's bag in his home study rather than in the office we saw patients together? I asked him if I could see what he kept inside his bag. He was uncomfortable with the idea and only reluctantly took it down for me to open. There was not much inside, prescription pads, his stethoscope, a blood pressure cuff, a reflex hammer. But after rummaging around for a while, I found at the bottom of a bag what I think I knew I would find. Beneath the instruments of his practice lay a syringe and a vial of antipsychotic medication. I didn't have to ask. It was for me, in case I became manic. Seeing the syringe triggered memories of being forcibly medicated after I first had become psychotic years earlier. I felt trapped and, more fundamentally, betrayed. Turning around, I saw Richard, who, like me, looked as though he had nowhere to run. He was a husband, but also a doctor, and he had to handle as best he could an illness he thought was unlikely to recur, but might. It was a dreary illness, and both of us had had our fill. After a long silence, he spoke with an unnerving calm. "Kay," he said, "I don't know what to do." He was silent for a long while. "Medicine is imperfect," he said. He paused again. "I am imperfect. You are imperfect." He looked tired and sad as he sat down at his desk. Neither of us said anything for a long time, caught in the cold realities of the choices we had. Then he added, very quietly, "Love is imperfect." It was the most true, most chilling thing I had heard about dealing with the uncertainties of an illness such as mine. Richard was doing the best he could. We both were. Love was imperfect, but it was what we had. And finally, before turning to a discussion of grief and differences with depression, I just want to give you a snippet of who Richard was like. Richard had a very wry sense of humor, very quick on the draw, unnervingly so often. And he was just fun to live with. We had actually, despite the chaos with my illness and then the real difficulties with his illnesses, we just had fun together. We enjoyed one another's company, and I will always feel blessed for the time that I had with him. But this was after I had gone public about my bipolar illness in the Washington Post and then in my book, An Unquiet Mind. Life had become sort of a swirl on occasion difficult for me, and he'd been quite wonderful about it. 6 months after I first discussed my bipolar illness in public, Richard and I spent our wedding anniversary in Rome, where he was giving a medical talk, and as part of a bicentennial lecture series about John Keats, I was speaking at the American Academy in Rome. We had several days together of aimless wanderings and evenings with friends, and on our anniversary, a romantic dinner on the rooftop of the Hotel Hassler where we were staying. It was a sweet lull in the wheeling days that had become our lives. Late one afternoon, after a long walk by myself, I returned to our room, where Richard had been working on a paper. It was evident he'd been up to something. "I got you some flowers," he said. I looked around the room and saw nothing. "But first you have to find them." His smile was broad, his mind afoot. I looked around the room again, but still could see no flowers. The only place left was the bathroom, so I opened the door. Richard had outdone himself. The bathtub was filled with floating blossoms of white and pink and lavender. It was a stunningly beautiful sight. I looked at the flowers more closely. They looked suspiciously familiar. They were. The day before, the staff of the Keats Shelley House had kindly sent me a beautiful bouquet of roses and lilacs to thank me for my lecture. Richard, while I was out on a walk, had removed the flowers from the vase, cut their stems, and set them a sail on the water. It was low cost and very Richard. He said eagerly, "Keep looking. You'll need to get down on your knees for this." Feeling mildly ridiculous and wheezing because I'm allergic to roses, I got down on my hands and knees to explore the blossoms as they drifted in the bathtub. My hands were cold and wet, and my knees soon sore, but I kept at it and finally discovered, attached by a paper clip and a rubber band to the stem of one of the roses, a pill bottle with a note inside. "Check the bed." It was a hunt. Richard was in his element. After a prolonged search of our exceedingly large bed, I found a small red box. It was from a jeweler in Rome, and inside on silk was an antique gold ring. Underneath one of the pillows was a note. "Thank you for the happiest year of my life," Richard had scratched in his dyslexic hand. "I know that talking and writing about your bipolar illness has been hard. I am very proud of you, not only as your husband, but as your colleague." The next morning, Richard dipped my new ring into the waters of the Trevi Fountain and then slipped it onto my finger next to my wedding band. "It would be with me when he could not," he said. "It would lessen the hurt from the cool silences or the sharp remarks and criticisms that might come my way because of my book." After we returned to Washington and criticism did lay me low, Richard was wry and loyal, and he brought me back again. When things went well, his joy was undiluted, and we hung the moon. We laughed and made love during those Italian days and thought our happiness imperishable. It was such a time of such closeness, as even now I cast back into those memories for assurance. I had Richard. We had each other. It was enough. Time sped by without our believing that it could end. Love pushed back our fears that his or my illness might come back, that one of us might die. It was a blithe time, and it did not last. Richard had been treated for stage 4B Hodgkin's disease when he was quite young. And though he was a scientist working at the NIH at the time, the NIH doctors suggested he go to Stanford, where the first experimental trials on Hodgkin's, aggressive treatment of Hodgkin's disease were being carried out. And like medicine at the cutting edge usually is, it was very aggressive treatment, and it was not the treatment that would be done now, I mean, because people learn, fortunately. He was given very aggressive amounts of radiation, not protected in the same way that he would be now, and very aggressive amounts of chemotherapy. The treatment gave him 30 years of life, which was extraordinary, and he was always extremely grateful for that, as was I. But it caught up with him, as happens now and again, and the radiation nearly killed him with heart disease. He had severe heart disease that was eventually treated well. He then had Burkitt's lymphoma, which is kind of a wildfire lymphoma, which was treated with a bone marrow transplant. And he was cured, completely cured of the Burkitt's. The Burkitt's was also caused by the radiation, the initial radiation treatment. And then several months after Richard had completely recovered from that, we'd really thrown ourselves back into life and doing our respective things and back into thinking we're not, perhaps not immortal, but more immortal than we had been. He had a follow-up visit with his oncologist who said, "Dr. Wyatt, you have a spot on your lung." And that was inoperable lung cancer, also from the radiation, and that is what he died from. We were fortunate that he had the kind of treatment that actually allowed him to live a couple of years, so we had a great deal of time together, which was quite wonderful, but he did die, and at that point, I think that I began to be quite seriously concerned about the possibility that I would get depressed just because I had a history of depression. I hadn't really been depressed in a long time. And what I found was actually I didn't. I really was well, and I didn't get depressed. I didn't get depressed for, a day or, certainly just not at all at that time. But I did grieve, and I became very interested in the distinctions between grieving and depression. So I thought I would just talk very briefly from a clinical point of view, very, very briefly, about a little bit about what we know about grief and depression, and then just read some of the what I wrote about it from a more personal point of view. And one of the things that we know is that, first and foremost, grief is part of the human condition. But on occasion, it becomes a disease. And when it becomes a disease, it has the potential to kill. depression and grief together are a particularly awful combination. It's a very real problem in terms of public health. I mean, nearly a million people are newly widowed each year in the United States, and by age 65, more than 50% of women and more than 10% of men will have been widowed. So this is not, you know, I think that it's a little ungluing to realize that these are actually reasonably young. By the time somebody's 65, you know, the equal number of women will have been widowed. About 40% of bereaved individuals will meet the criteria for a full-blown major depressive episode within 2 months following the death of a spouse, and 15% within the year. But it's important to realize that grief and depression are clearly not the same thing. Grief can trigger an underlying depression, a mood disorder, and depression can very much worsen and complicate grief, but they're not the same. But what we do know is that bereavement will lead to chronic depression in 10 to 15% of spouses unless people are treated. And unfortunately, the group in society that is most likely to be affected by the death of a spouse, namely those people over 65 or about the age of 65, is the same age group that is also greatly undertreated for depression. And so it's very important that psychiatrists and psychologists and internists and GPs are aware that, you know, just marking off somebody's depressive symptoms as a natural response or grief may or may not be correct. There are similarities certainly between grief and depression, low mood in particular, and social withdrawal. People withdraw for a while. But in grief, what you see is people are much more responsive to the world around them, to other people. Whereas depression is a much more pervasive state. It's much more difficult to break into depression. It's not that difficult to break into grief. I mean, people will get up, go out with friends, go to work, and so forth. The major risk factor for getting depressed during time of grief is not surprisingly a previous history of depression, and particularly depression that has not been treated. And what we know is that antidepressants are actually very effective in treating major depression that occurs in the context of bereavement, and there are also particular kinds of psychotherapies that are very effective. So what you don't want to do, above all, is you don't want to medicalize the human condition. You don't want to start throwing medications and psychotherapy at people because they're grieving, because it's human to grieve, and you don't want to interfere in that sense. But you also want to treat people who otherwise would be in a great deal of pain. And that's sort of the great task of being a good clinician and a good priest and good rabbi, all the people that come to that are come to during times of grief, which are doctors and religious people and family members. So as I say, it's terribly important to make that distinction between grief and depression. And I was worried about it. And in fact, the sort of start off my book by saying that the hardest single decision of my life was the night before my husband died, when he was in the ICU, and I had not had much sleep, and I had to choose between staying in his room with him, and I knew I wouldn't sleep, or going to a nearby hotel room and getting sleep. And everything that Richard had taught me about the importance of sleep stayed with me. And I went to the hotel and prayed that he would stay alive long enough that I could be with him when he died. And fortunately, he was. But it's one of those things where if you do have a vulnerability to this kind of depression or bipolar illness, sleep is the single most important thing. And in fact, one of my colleagues, the night after Richard died, one of my colleagues from Hopkins brought down a prescription for me that he had filled, because he knew I wasn't going to go to a doctor, and he knew I wasn't going to stand in line to get a prescription filled, of sleeping medications. And it was the single most helpful thing that anybody did. So let me just read a little bit about from a chapter called Mourning and Melancholia, and then open it up for questions or comments. I did not get depressed after Richard died, nor did I go mad. I was distraught, but it was not the desperation of clinical depression. I was restless, but but it was not the agitation of mania. My mind was not right, but it was not deranged. I was able to reason and to imagine that the future held better things for me than the present. I did not think of suicide. Yet Richard's death stirred up such a darkness in me that I was forced to examine those things depression and grief hold in common, and those they do not. The differences were essential, the similarities confounding. I did not, after Richard died, lose my sense of who I was as a person, or how to navigate the basics of life as one does in depression. I lost a man who had been the most important person in my life and around whom my future spun. I lost many of my dreams, but not the ability to dream. The loss of Richard was devastating, but it was not deadly. I knew depression to be unrelenting, invariable, impervious to event. I knew its pain to be undeviating. Grief was different. It hit in waves, caught me unawares. It struck me when I felt most alive, when I thought I had moved beyond its hold. I am so much better dealing with his being gone, I would say to myself, assured by some new pleasure in life. Then I would be flung far and cold by a wave of longing I could scarcely stand. I learned to live in expectation of assault. From nowhere, a memory of Richard would compel me like some recollected scent into a region of my mind whose existence I had forgotten. Then I would coil to protect myself, huddled as prey against predator. He cannot be gone, I would rail against the gods, again in the presence of his absence. He will not be back, I would know after each new confrontation. It became clearer over time, less wavering. He will not be back. He has been away too long. Grief, said C.S. Lewis, is like a winding valley where any bend may reveal a totally new landscape. This is true. The lessons that come from grief come from its unexpected moves, from its shifting views of what has gone before and what is yet to come. Pain brought so often into one's consciousness cannot maintain the same capacity to wound. Grief conspires to ensure that it will in time wear itself out. Unlike depression, it acts to preserve the self. Depression is malignant, indiscriminately destructive. Grief may bear a resemblance to depression, but it is a distant kinship. I was notably restless in the months after Richard died, and disturbed by this, I spoke to my psychiatrist, concerned that I might be getting ill again. He reassured me that such restlessness was unavoidable and probably a necessary part of grieving. In time, it became less distracting and distressing. It was never the perturbing agitation of mania. So too, the sadness of grief was never so extreme as that of depression. It did not obliterate my reason. I was profoundly unhappy and distraught in the months after Richard died, but I was never hopeless. My mood, fixedly bleak during depression, was not so during grief. It was mutable and commonly rose in response to the presence of my family and friends. I was generally able to meet the demands of the world. I conserved my energy, but was able to call upon it when I had to. Like a butterfly in the rain, I sought hiding places and kept my wings folded tight about me until I had no choice but to move. When I did move, I did have to move, albeit gingerly and not far. In time, the weather cleared. Even during the worst of my grief, I had some sense that this would happen, that the weather would clear. I did not have this faith during the merciless months of depression. Grief cut me some slack. Memories came unsought and disturbed my equanimity, but still, they carried with them an occasional sweetness, a periodic tincture of life. My thoughts did not dwell on the pointlessness of life. They dwelled instead on the pain of missing a life. Hope can find a place in a mind missing love. It cannot find a place in a mind taken over by depression. In depression, it is otherwise. One cannot access the beat of life. One of the things that I was particularly struck by, and then I'll just end on the human nature of grief, is that one of the other things, aside from the personal experience of grief being so different from depression, even though there's some overlaps, is how different society responds to people who are depressed and people who are grieving. When you're grieving, over the since the first death, there's been mourning and mourning rituals. And society has evolved incredibly complex and quite fertile ways of dealing with people who grieve. People, when you're grieving, understand at some general level why you're grieving. And they often are grieving for the same person, perhaps not in the same way. But there's a common understanding, there's a common human understanding of what loss is and that it might happen to them. As a result, the rights of religion, the rights of social passage, all make for a much warmer response to somebody who mourns. What happens when people are depressed is, could not be more different. It's alienating, it's alienated. People have no idea what to do with you when you're depressed. And it's not like you're Charm City yourself when you're depressed. So nobody wants to be around you. You're generally irritable, paranoid. You're not giving other people the benefit of the doubt. Moods are contagious, and depression is contagious. So all the things that people need when they're depressed, they seldom get from other people. We have not figured out a way of ministering to those who are depressed as opposed to those who grieve. So I just want to end on a brief section about the importance of grief. Blessing may break from stone, wrote the Scottish poet George Mackay Brown. Who knows how? Grief is such a stone. It gives much to the living. It slows time that one might find a way to a different relationship with the dead. It fractures time to bring into awareness what is being mourned, and why. I remember an afternoon at the Natural History Museum in Washington, standing in front of a glass case filled with mummified owls. It seemed a violation of wild things to see such creatures stuffed and fakely perched. Yet had they not been dead and fixed, I could not have seen their wings and claws so clearly. I could not have appreciated the intricate beauty of their feathers and beaks. Had it not been for their deaths, I could not have seen what made them live. I would have preferred to have seen them fly or hunt or take a mouse to beak. But with them dead, I took in with awe their parts and proportions, saw in their stillness what made a snowy owl and not an eastern screech. Death had something to give. Grief, lashed as it is to death, instructs. It teaches that one must invent a way back to life. Grief forces intimacy with death. It preserves the salient past, and it puts into relief our mortal state. All die, says Ecclesiastes. All must die, it is written in the first statute of the Magna Carta. All die, teaches grief. Grief is at the heart of the human condition. Much is lost with death, but not everything. Life is not let loose of lightly, nor is love. There is a grace in death. There is life. Thank you. Was I influenced by other memoirs, especially The Year of Magical Thinking? No, not by memoirs. And I have to say, perhaps I was influenced slightly with the Joan Didion book in the sense that I had a problem relating to who her husband was and what it was she was mourning. And I felt very strongly that, to me, grief meant there was an individual life that was gone, and what that life was in, one's own life. So in that sense, but I don't think, no, I wouldn't say that I was influenced. What I was influenced more by was the power of literature, once Richard had died, to provide solace. Unlike music, I had thought I would be able to reach out to classical music for solace. It never occurred to me that I could not. As a matter of fact, we were talking about this. We did a concert at the Library of Congress a couple of nights ago, and the head of Juilliard School was saying exactly the same thing, that you think you're going to get solace from music, and you may or may not. I got solace from hymns. I couldn't get solace from Beethoven and Schumann, who were my favorite composers. It was too painful. It was too raw. It was too exquisitely painful, and I had to go back to them months later. But where I did get a lot of solace was from literature. I had, when I was 17 or 18, after I was psychotically depressed in high school, I had read Tennyson's In Memoriam, and it had been something that I really responded to at the time because of the perturbance and the agitation and the not easy solutions to pain and suffering. And I took that down again, and I took down Douglas Dunn's, the Scottish poet's contemporary poet, who'd written elegies. And I found both of those books of incredible solace, incredible solace. So I wouldn't say memoirs. They're the first-person accounts of grief. I mean, C.S. Lewis I had read years and years and years ago, and I remember liking, but I didn't go back to reading. I went back to reading poetry primarily. Yeah. Yes. Well, certainly, I would answer that in two ways. I mean, humanistic response, hopefully, and a medical response, and they do bear some resemblance to one another. From a medical or a clinical point of view, there are varying criteria for how long you can be quite seriously depressed and have it be considered grief rather than depression, ranging from 2 to 6 months, depending on which studies you read. Now, I think anybody who's been through profound grief would say that this whole notion that you should sort of just be over things in 6 months or a year is ridiculous. You know, some people are, and some people really do seem to deal with grief rather more rapidly than others. But most people go on for years in one way or another, and it comes, and it is in this capacity of grief to come in waves. You know, to represent something when you least expect it. And to, you know, it's just like being blindsided by this terrible wave of longing and sometimes regret and missing. So, you know, people, I think the human experience of grief is that it goes on and on and on. And that if you talk to mothers who've lost a child, they will say it goes on and on and on, you know, it never stops. It just, the intensity and the frequency of it may change. But, you know, in a way, it keeps you in the presence of somebody. It's unhealthy if it's keeping you from doing other things and from reengaging in life. But it's not surprising that people continue to remember with strong intensity someone who's died. Yes? The question is, I mean, is it natural or helpful to hold yourself back from being totally engulfed by grief? First of all, many people don't have the option, they just simply are, and I think that's particularly true early on in grief. I think to the extent that people set limits on themselves, people have a pretty good gauge of how much they can stand. And it is the sort of thing that these waves come and go for a reason. I mean, if people were just engulfed at a single level of being overwhelmed by the pain and intensity of the loss, nobody would ever get over grief. I mean, you have to get over grief in the sense you have to get over that kind of acute, paralyzing quality of grief, or the species would come to a screeching halt. So, you know, I think it sounds to me she may well be protecting herself. You know, I'm not a great believer that you just kind of say, okay, just flat out go with your grief and just die with it. You know, I don't think I don't think that's probably very helpful. I think there's a reason why these things come in grief, in waves. And each of those waves, even though it may seem an intense event and overpowering intensity, each time people do get a little bit more acclimated to it. And I think that's one of the reasons why these things come in waves. Yes. Well, I think in grief, I think it's much, the capacity for denial almost by definition is much less. There's a much more obvious focus as a cause, and people are engaged in the rituals of life that are, you know, focused on everything from the funeral to, you know, a month memorial, 6 month memorial to, you know, All Saints Day to whatever. These rituals kind of are focused on the cause of the pain. In the case of depression and denial and bipolar illness, there's no question that there is a level of denial in all of these disorders. I think that, you know, and it certainly nearly cost me my life, and it certainly kept me from taking my medications as prescribed for quite a while. And I'd be the last to minimize that. A lot of the reason why I wrote an Unquiet Mind was I didn't want people to go through what I went through in terms of denying their illness. On the other hand, I also am a great believer that denial serves a function. There's a reason why we deny things. And I think if you're 18, 19, 20 years old, and somebody tells you you have a potentially fatal disease and you've got medications that are going to be really problematic, you know, and buck up, take it in, acknowledge it, while all your friends are reading with ease and doing sports with ease and healthy and don't have this kind of thing hanging over their head, there's a reason why people deny. And I think there's a reason why, I mean, I think that the same side of people being independent often is that they are, you know, and I would count myself in that particular group. I mean, I was brought up in the military and, you know, you just got on with things. And part of getting on with things is denial. You know, if you really think about what you have to deal with, you will never get out of bed in the morning. I mean, I really believe that. So denial, it does exist for a reason. So I think this tendency to just want to break down denial is not necessarily always healthy. And I sometimes think my colleagues get a little eager beaver on this point. It doesn't mean that you want to capitulate or collude with denial. It does mean you want to say, what role is this particular denial serving in this particular person's life? Some of the denial in bipolar illness, of course, comes from a very addictive portion of the illness, which is namely the early stages of mania, which in 50% of people who have bipolar illness, highly, highly seductive, and not only seductive, I think genuinely addictive states. So people get addicted to their own brains. And in that sense, it's not that unlike cocaine addiction or anything else. The obliteration of reason in the pursuit of pleasure is hard for people to understand who have not experienced that particular level of pleasure. You know, that's just true. I mean, I think people who've not had the highs, the good highs, as opposed to the bad highs, the good highs, simply don't have a clue of how marvelous they can be. Now, that is, it's of course denial to believe in those so entirely that you forget how lethal and destructive the illness is. So I think, you know, to the extent that people will read to the people, for example, here at UVA, I was just talking at lunch. I mean, there's a group of four, a support group, therapy group for eight students with bipolar illness. I think that kind of thing, where you're talking about your peers, where you've got similar kinds of problems, where people can deal with issues in their own way at their own time, is a very effective one. But it's the hardest question in treating bipolar illness. One is getting people into treatment. The second is keeping them in treatment and recognizing they have a bad disease. It's not that we don't have good medications and good psychotherapies. We do. The problem is exactly that problem. Nobody has figured out an answer to that yet. Yes. The grief is because he was diagnosed with schizophrenia? Right. My inclination, without getting into the specifics of it, would be to, you know, just talk to somebody about it and get an opinion on that. Eight years is you know, is probably a long time to deal with that. It's very, very hard with when you have a child with a chronic illness. You know, there are great programs like NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, has great family programs and family support programs and education programs. And those can be very, very helpful to parents who are going through dealing with all of the issues that come along with having a child with schizophrenia. So I'm sure here in Charlottesville there's a NAMI group. Yes, and the question is whether that's grief or distress or depression. And you know, I think that's again that would be an issue that's very personal and would need a professional attention. But I mean, discussion. Yeah.
Was there any point at which your grief had a kind of complexity to it that you felt there were some rumblings that had to do with the underlying bipolar disorder?
No, only when I got, I mean, I was very restless. And, I mean, I'm generally restless, but I was much more restless than usual. And I hadn't realized, and I suppose that's one of the things that I love about Tennyson, is that restlessness, is that grief has a lot of restlessness in it and a lot of perturbance and agitation. And, but as I say, I did call my psychiatrist. My psychiatrist lives in L.A., and I called him and said that I was worried because I was so restless. And he said, you know, he said that's human restlessness, and you know, I ask a slew of questions and so forth. And it actually made me feel better just to hear that. I mean, it wasn't a problem. I mean, he did, I think, at some point, but this was long after the period of grief, he did say that, well, maybe at some point when I was a little high energy that I might consider increasing my lithium, but that was not in context of grief. That was just a couple years ago. And when I said to him, you know, if you love lithium so much, why don't you take it? and I said, you know, I don't mind taking the amount that I'm taking, but and he said, you know, Kay, he said, I've been treating you for more than 30 years, and he said, you haven't changed a bit. But it was at that point I did think that maybe I needed to be on more lithium, and he said absolutely not. You know, this is human. This is what people do when they grieve. And he was actually he was terrifically good, because he had a large practice, and he worked at the VAs, and he had a private practice. So he had a combination of different types of patients, all of whom had been through grief. So he had this huge experience with what people did during grief, and he kept saying, he said, don't put any timelines on this, you know, which is people really want you to sort of tidy up your life and move right along. So that was helpful not to be able not to do that. Yes. With difficulty. The question is how, in the context of an academic career, how did I deal with not being able to read very well? When I was on when I was first prescribed lithium, which is a very effective drug for me, and, you know, so no complaints in some fundamental sense, I was kept at very, very high levels. And that was standard medical practice at the time, and it's also what it took to sort of stabilize my manias. At that time, I had very, very bad vision. I went to see a neuro-ophthalmologist at UCLA who helped somewhat but couldn't help with most of it. And I had to, every single, first of all, I was used to reading 3 or 4 books a week, and I didn't read a book cover to cover for 10 years. So in that sense, I didn't read, you know, that. In terms of scientific papers, I would underline, I would highlight everything, and then I would underline it, and then I would write it out. So, I mean, if you think scientific papers are boring the first time through, I would just write it. I would have to go through the physical act of writing for it somehow to get coded in my brain. The writing was easier, but the reading was terribly, terribly difficult. And I would write notes, I mean, note cards and note cards and note cards. It was hard. I mean, anybody who's had significant visual problems for many of the psychiatric drugs will appreciate that. And concentration, it's not just vision. Yeah. Two people? Okay. The one furthest to the right. My right. Did my husband grieve his impending death? No, he did not. Interestingly, my husband was actually a remarkably philosophical man and very low-key. He very much wanted to live. He did everything possible to live. He was a great example of just taking every medication without complaining, going through all these procedures and so forth without complaining. He didn't talk about death a lot. I think he felt very strongly, and he wrote about this a bit, that, you know, death for him was really basically having the scorecard clean in terms of his obligations to life. And he felt very strongly he'd been given a great deal in life, and that he had hoped that over the years he had been able to even the toll. So he wanted very much to live. He didn't have a depressive bone or molecule in his body. That made life much, much easier for both of us, I think. He was clear-eyed, lucid. He had no denial. As a matter of fact, when I went to the funeral home, which is, you know, one of those grim things everybody has to do, to make plans before he died, I spoke to the funeral director in Washington, and he said, "Does your husband know that you're here?" And I said, "Yes, of course. I mean, you know." He said, "You'd be surprised at how many husbands don't know their wives are here." And I thought, boy, you know, that said a lot. And so he dealt with it straight on. The only time I saw him in any way, I would say, sad or reflective was the last day that he was conscious, which was a couple of days before he died. And we were reading together, and he had asked me to read from Robert Louis Stevenson something. I was reading to him a book I was writing about exuberance, and I had referenced Stevenson. He wanted me to read the essay. And he said something about, you know, that he... it was very hard to take the fact that in 20 years, the science that would be commonplace knowledge for everyone in science, would most of it he wouldn't know. That he would never know what caused schizophrenia. He would never know the treatments or the genetics of schizophrenia. And it was as close to, you know, but he wasn't even that sad. And I said, you know, it is the nature of science and medical research that you don't. I mean, it's always advancing, and nobody ever knows. And it is transient. Knowledge is transient in that sense. But think of all the people you've trained and all the excitement that you've caused with people you've trained and so forth. And he ended up being in a good mood. But that's the only time I actually saw him really, you know, deeply upset about it. I think he really was pretty philosophical, amazingly so. I thought he was amazing. One of the reasons I wrote about him, aside from the fact that I was crazy in love with him, was the fact that he was a very admirable human being. Yes. Oh, who was the person that back there that didn't speak? Well, jeeps. it can be an indiscriminate diagnosis on the basis of people just taking a few symptoms. Generally, it's not to say that bipolar illness can't first occur later in life, but it's unusual. And usually, you'd look for a family history, you'd look for a personal history, and it would be pretty unusual. You might have some of the behaviors that are consistent with bipolar illness show up, in terms of certain kinds of aggressiveness, in terms of certain kinds of cognitive issues and so forth. But I think it would be pretty unusual. Is Dr. Holroyd here? Dr. Holroyd? Dr. Holroyd, I'll punt to you. Yeah, that's what I thought you were saying, was that it first showed up in the context of Alzheimer's. So maybe one more question? Yeah.
I'm just curious. By the way, thank you very much. I referenced you in my dissertation. I had lost a partner to suicide, and my research became about the social effects on people who have lost someone suddenly in suicide. And as a result of that, I tend to treat suicide survivors, people who lost someone to suicide, in my private practice as a psychotherapist. And what I've noticed that sometimes it seems like there's a, besides the shattered assumption belief that people, sometimes it's the grieving of what will never happen, what will never transpire.
Absolutely. I haven't, no. There's, as you know, a lot of work going on now about complicated grief, a phrase that I must say I always find rather peculiar, just because by definition I think grief is complicated and life is complicated and people are complicated. And calling it complicated grief, some of my New York colleagues do this a lot. And but, I mean, it's still is obviously a very important field to study. And they do look at some of those things, and that particularly in the context of using cognitive psychotherapy and interpersonal therapy with people who have grief that has been complicated by early issues of loss that are re-triggered and aggravate current grief. Thank you very much.
I am, thanks.